Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, maps of the airfield, Q&A episodes, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content that may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. The evening was coming to a close at Mason Arms, and the airmen were ready to move on to the next drinking stop along their path. Jack and Maggie were still sitting at the table, and both had more than enough to drink, as their clear, flirtatious body language sent a message to every person around them that something was brewing between these two people. Parnell visibly looked more and more upset by Jack's actions, and once the group got up, Jack proceeded to invite Maggie to follow him and the rest of the group to their next drinking establishment. Maggie seemed to love the idea and excused herself while she went to the restroom. Jack communicated that he'd wait for her, and as he did, that's when Parnell took Jack aside and asked him,
"Louis, what the hell do you think you're doing?"
"Nothing that concerns you, Dad."
"Don't. I'm looking out for you, okay? Louis, you know what you're getting yourself into, right?"
"I'm making a friend, Parnell. Don't get all high and mighty on me."
"Louis, look, I know you've had it rough the last few—"
Don't even start.
"For Christ's sake, stop talking to me like I'm some poor, broken fucking soul, okay? We've all had it rough these last few days, weeks, months, hell, even years. I'm just enjoying myself, as everyone else."
"Louis, you're getting yourself into something that you're going to regret the moment your buzz wears off."
"Parnell, I'm doing what I want to do. And when I already regret so much, God damn it, this by comparison is the least of the things that I'm going to regret. At least I'm getting pleasure attached to this one. You're really going to do this? You really want to ruin the first good night I've had in weeks?"
"Louis, I'm trying to be a good friend. I'm not trying to do anything else but stop you from making a critical mistake. I mean, what will these guys think of you?"
Parnell said as he pointed to Coca, O'Brien, and Brolin.
"Those guys understand."
"Sure they do.
But they will also lose complete and total respect for you."
"Well, are you going to lose respect for me over this?"
"Maybe I will."
"Well, then fuck you, and fuck them too,"
Jack yelled as he proceeded to walk towards the front of the bar, where Maggie would soon exit the bathroom and disappear with Jack outside the pub. Days later, May 21st, 1944, United States Army Air Force Station 186, Thurlow, England, 0600. The men were exiting the briefing room and were now headed to their specific briefings or to meet up with their crews at the vehicle depot. Stepping outside was Jack, his co-pilot Ryan Beck, his new navigator Ryan or Reinhold Holt, and a replacement bombardier, Lieutenant Mark Dillard. The boss had approached Jack early in the morning the previous day and simply told Jack that he was going to give him command of Lota Bull and officially told him that Ryan and Reinhold were indefinitely new members of the crew. Jack didn't get too heavily invested in what the boss was saying, but did show some appreciation for the gesture and consideration. The two didn't speak about anything else, but kept it professional as the two parted ways shortly after. However, It wasn't until this morning, when he got selected to fly today's mission, and when he saw who he'd be flying with, that it all became real for him. He was going to embark on his 14th mission, this time as the commander of his own crew. The target for today was an oil refinery and storage facility in Hamburg, Germany. The target sent a large group of selected officers into a tizzy, since Hamburg was a heavily defended target, with enough flak guns and nearby airfields to get even the most hardened airmen's knees knocking. Jack kept his cool, and so did the other men, surprisingly. Even though the rest of the officers in Jack's crew today were new, they all had flown more than a handful of dangerous missions, and were by no means green. In fact, Jack couldn't help but take pride in the men that he'd be flying with today, and couldn't wait to introduce the newest members of his crew to the enlisted men. As Jack and Beck talked about the mission, Reinhold excused himself as he shared that he wanted to head to the navigator's briefing. The group waved him off, and that's when Lieutenant Dillard shared that he too wanted to attend the bombardier's briefing. With a simple smile on his face, he nodded his head and excused the very professional and very serious bombardier.
"I like him,"
Beck commented.
"He's alright. Hey, his first mission was to Brunswick. He's definitely won my trust. Bet he never thought he'd be flying with the crew that put him in that situation."
"I hear you. Now, are we going to briefing or are we going to meet up with the rest of the crew?"
Beck asked.
"Do you want to go to the pilot's briefing?"
"Hell no. I'm going to fall asleep if I don't get moving and get the juices flowing."
"I agree. Yeah, let's introduce you to the guys,"
Jack said as he and Beck made their way over to the troop trucks. Willie and Tommy had just arrived at the vehicle that they would be taking to their plane today, a short bed British Fortson Watt 8. This was a vehicle that the 300th was borrowing on loan from a nearby RAF field while they had a few troop trucks repaired. As they arrived at the vehicle, they were amused at finding Muth and Mills already there, with their equipment laying on the back of the truck bed. The two men were examining the unique-looking vehicle, and once they heard the incoming sounds of footsteps from their crew members, they turned around, and that's when Mills called out,
"Hey! Great minds think alike! Look at this thing!"
"Jesus, did our douche and a half give birth to this fucking thing? Is this what the Brits use?"
asked Willie.
"Yes, sir. I was gonna see if the driver would let me take it to the hard stand,"
uttered Mills.
"You seriously think he's gonna let you?"
Tommy asked.
"Yeah, why not? I'm a goddamn sergeant. The guy driving this thing is a lower rank than me. I bet he hasn't even fired a weapon, or had one fired at him since basic."
"Yep, and I still have my hearing because of it,"
yelled the driver.
"Oops,"
Mills said under his breath as he glanced over at Muth embarrassingly.
"Do you guys know where we're going?"
Muth asked, changing subjects, trying to escape the possible secondhand embarrassment.
"No, we were headed here right before the officers walked out of the briefing,"
mentioned Tommy.
"Damn. Hey, you fellas, you know where we're heading today?"
Mills yelled to a group of passing officers and enlisted men as they were heading towards the airfield.
"Yeah, fucking Hamburg,"
yelled out one of the officers from the 528th Squadron.
"Hamburg? Haven't we flown there before?"
asked Tommy.
"Hamburg, not Hamburg, and no to either one," commented Mills.
"What does that mean?" asked Willie.
"We're gonna find out, I hope,"
Tommy joked. Just then, that's when Jack and Beck arrived at the troop truck. Upon the many requests for further information, Jack continued to repeat that he would further explain things once they got to the hard stand. As Jack introduced Beck to the group, Jack noticed that Beck and the men seemed to be interacting with one another in a very natural manner that brought Jack a lot of comfort. As Jack took in the moment, that's when he heard someone calling his name from behind him. Turning around, Jack was immediately annoyed with seeing that it was Parnell who was approaching him. Since Parnell, or his crew, wasn't selected to fly today, Parnell was not dressed in flight clothes, but instead was wearing just his summertime fatigues and looked like he hadn't slept.
"Louis, can I borrow you for a moment?"
Jack sighed and then looked around at the men, seeing what their reactions were. To Jack's embarrassment, the men were all staring at Parnell and Jack with a look of amusement and confusion. Jack begrudgingly turned towards Parnell, and as he arrived at his friends, that's when Parnell began to say before Jack was cut off,
"This won't take long. I just want to..."
"What the hell are you doing? You weren't selected to fly today. You have no reason to be out here right now."
"No reason? Listen, Jesus Christ, don't be such a dramatic Mary, Louis. Look, I just wanted to say that I'm sorry.
Sorry?
Sorry for what?
I'm sorry for the way I acted yesterday.
It's okay. I don't need you to be my father, all right? Besides, like I told you, we didn't do anything. You saw we were with you guys the entire time, both two nights ago and yesterday. There wasn't a moment that we could have done anything. I'm more so just looking for someone that I don't have to see get butchered up. And I appreciate you looking after me, but as I told Sheila and Coco last night, I'm a full-grown man and I can make my own decisions. Behind Parnell's eyes, Jack could see that Parnell had a lot more to say, but instead of saying them, Parnell just smiled and asked,
"First day as the pilot in chief of your own crew, huh? Where are you guys going today?"
Surprised that Parnell was changing conversation, Jack paused for a moment before answering,
"Homburg."
"Homburg, huh? Happy hunting, Louis. Go squash the Huns for us out there. You up for a drink tonight?"
Parnell asked.
"Sure, if I come back."
"Don't give me that shit, Louis. Your ass is coming back here one way or another,"
Parnell said, tipping his officer's hat towards Jack. Jack mimicked the gesture and replied,
"Aye, aye, sir,"
before turning back around and heading back to the troop truck.
"Hey, what the hell was that all about?"
Willie asked. "Nothing. Me and your mother will tell you when you get older," Jack shot back, much to the chagrin and amusement of the group. Soon after, the rest of Little Bull arrived, and together the men got inside the troop truck and headed towards their hard stand. About 5 minutes later, the group arrived at their hard stand and were preparing for takeoff, which was just about 40 minutes away. Opening the nose compartment underbelly hatch, Jack threw his gear inside and proceeded to help Beck, Reinhold, and Dillard get in before he flipped himself up into the war-ready Warbird. Once inside the cockpit, Jack and Beck decided that Jack would do the interior checklist, while Beck would do the exterior checklist. And after Beck got everything of his stored away and set up, he made his way out through the nose hatch and onto terra firma. As Jack started going through the pilot's checklist, that's when Willie arrived at the top turret gunner's position and asked Jack,
"Hey Shay, what kind of day are we going to have, Chief?"
Jack couldn't help but push through his feelings of nervousness and anxiety-riddled thinking and crack a large grin at the sound of his crew member calling him Chief. Seeing Jack smile, Willie asked,
"Did I say the she-word? Too soon?"
No, sorry.
"Sorry? There's no need to apologize, sir. You damn near earned that sheet that you're shitting in."
Jack at this point looked back over his position in the pilot's seat of the cockpit, and while this wasn't his first time obviously sitting in the pilot's seat of a fortress, this was the first time sitting in the pilot's seat of Loda Bull. A sudden feeling of pride and accomplishment washed over Jack, and soon, Jack snapped out of his moment of self-grandizement and focused on his pre-flight checklist. About 10 minutes later, Jack finished his internal pre-flight checklist and announced that everyone needed to meet him under the nose of Loda Bull in 5 minutes for a mission huddle. Minutes later, Jack and the rest of Loda Bull found themselves huddled around one another in a large circle, with Reinhold and Beck both standing on either side of Jack as the huddle began. Taking in the moment and the men's faces as they all stood looking at him in a way that they hadn't looked at him yet, Jack took a deep breath before digging into his pocket for a cigarette. And once he grabbed one and lit it, that's when Jack began his speech.
"Gentlemen, we've got a high-priority mission today, straight from Doolittle himself. We're going to Homburg today to bomb an oil field, and here's what we've got to look forward to. We'll be 300 forts strong today, with the 300th and 530th leading the rear in Fox Group. We'll be positioned in a good spot in the formation, with Hellfire leading, Grey Thunder as the number 2, Billy Mitchell in the number 3, us in the number 4, Bitter Boy to our 8 o'clock, Jack the Ripper to our 5 o'clock, and Beck's old crew, Desperate Journey, flying off our 6 o'clock. Marshy, that means you'll have extra coverage back there. Brass says that we should expect heavy fighter opposition, especially since, according to Lord Haha, the Huns know that we're coming. We can also expect the flak to be heavy and accurate, since, well, we all know the Germans love their oil, and we'll make sure that we have a tough time getting to it. So, as always, keep calm over the intercom, call out fighters and any downed bombers you may see, keep the intercom clear once we cross the channel, and check your oxygen mask constantly. Any questions?
What about escorts?
Asked Mills.
Yes, we're getting 2 squadrons of P-47s to the coast and 2 squadrons of P-51s after we hit the target.
Wow, P-51s. We're getting spoiled,
Tommy joked.
Right? Any other questions?
Jack asked the group. Silence fell among the men. Jack then concluded the huddle, and once he did, that's when Butch invited the men for a quick cup of coffee, since they had close to 15 minutes before the mission started. Soon, the men had one last smoke, a huge gulp of coffee, and made their way inside the plane, where they would prepare for takeoff.
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you, because you can. You see, by visiting our website, www.snafupod.net, you can find all kinds of amazing free, it's important, free resources to help you find out more about the 8th Air Force from World War II and about the B-17 Flying Fortress. Right now, you can take a virtual tour of 2 real B-17s like the ones depicted in Snafu. Also, you can find links to movies, documentaries, and free YouTube videos, and much, much, much more. All you have to do is visit www.snafupod.net and check it out for yourself. Now, back to the podcast.
Jack looked down at his watch and read that it was 10:34. It had been 3 hours and 19 minutes since the men of the Bull started their engines and began their mission, and were now set to arrive at the decision point. Any minute now, the formation would be passing over the small German village of Kankt Ebert and would make the decision to either go for the primary target, the synthetic oil plant in Hamburg, the secondary target, which was the ball-bearing factory in Stuttgart, or the tertiary target, a rail junction just outside of Heidelberg. Looking around at the beautiful morning sky, Jack felt uneasy at the thick layer of clouds that hung below them and seemed to be following them ever since they arrived over Luxembourg. In the back of the plane, Marshy was staring out through his tail gunner's glass box. Marshy, along with the others of the crew, expected to see a lot more fighters in flak since they were flying deep into the Reich, but so far, distant and inaccurate flak seemed to be the only threat being posed to the formation and the men of the Bull. In the one sense, this became a huge relief to the men like Marshy, but in another sense, it only brought them more anxiety, since they knew that at any moment, their convenient, safe journey would be cut short and chaos would ensue. Just 2 nights previous, Marshy overheard some enlisted men from the 381st Bomb Group talk about not seeing a single fighter all the way to their target, only to get swarmed with a dozen unified German fighter squadrons, all bloodthirsty and ready to cause chaos. The enlisted men said that the sheer size and number of fighters was too much for even the escorts to handle, and the formation that the 381st was flying in nearly lost 20 forts that day. Now, Marshy was smart enough to know that these kinds of statements, especially out of the mouths of drunken gunners, wasn't always accurate, and sometimes could be laced with over-the-top exaggerations to express not what happened, but how it felt to be caught up in the hell of aerial combat. However, Marshy knew that there was a chance that the enlisted men were correct, and if they were, then the lack of seeing attacking fighters could be the calm before the storm.
Navigator to pilot, we're at the waypoint. Your new heading is 073 easy. Again, that is 073 easy.
Reinhold called out over the intercom.
073 easy. Roger that.
Jack confirmed as the Bull, along with the other planes in the formation, banged to the east as they were now heading towards Hamburg. As soon as they leveled out, that's when Tommy down in the ball turret started noticing the flak was getting closer and closer to them and was getting more and more intense.
Flak's picking up, fellas,
Tommy called out.
I see that,
Mills confirmed.
Hey, we're less than 5 minutes from the target. If you don't have your flak jackets and helmets on, you better get them on now,
Beck called out.
Roger that. Getting mine on now,
commented Muth.
Hey, Marshy, are you wearing something back there?
Mills asked.
Just a rubber.
Marshy joked, getting a few chuckles from Tommy and a few others. Rolling his eyes, Mills replied,
Strap your parachute on, at least. Mills, you don't have to say that every mission. I always wear my chute.
Marshy called out.
Hey, enough chatter, fellas. It's showtime.
Commented Willie.
Thank you, Willie.
Jack exclaimed as the sounds of flak shells began to creep up its way through the thin morning air and the roaring sounds of engines. Within a few seconds, the sky around Loda Bowl and the rest of the formation was being peppered by black puffs of clouds left behind by the exploding flak shells. Unfortunately, it didn't take long for the flak to claim its first victim. Up ahead in the first group, a B-17 from the 379th Bomb Group took a near-direct hit from a flak shell, which went off just mere feet from its number one and two engines. Flames erupted from the bomber's engines, and soon, men could be seen bailing out of the waste compartment door.
B-17 from the 379 going down, 12 o'clock level.
Just then, the portside gas tanks were ignited as the flames spread along the metal wing. The explosion tore the fortress to shreds. Both metal and airmen were sent flying out of the stricken bomber. Jack and a few others from the 300th made maneuvers as to avoid any debris. However, not every plane was successful.
Oh, shit!
Claimed Mills.
What?
Beans asked.
Plane from the 528 flew right into something. We're going down.
Mills exclaimed, watching a B-17 with a huge gash in its nose compartment and cockpit area, quickly losing altitude. The plane had no visible nose art on its port side, so Mills didn't know which plane this was, but knew the plane was fairly new.
Any chance?
Asked Muth.
I see one, maybe two. Oh no, I lost them. I'm lucky. I only see two.
Tommy called in.
Oh, come on, guys, come on.
Muttered Marshy as he watched the parachutes blossom into the far distance. Seconds later, the plane fell behind in the clouds.
It's gone. Yeah, I only counted two chutes.
Tommy confirmed for Muth. Up in the cockpit, Jack was attempting to keep Loda Bull on a straight path while other planes were bouncing around due to flak going off.
We're at the AP. Navigate on pilot. Continue on heading 073 easy. Again, continue on heading 073 easy. Roger that. Pilot to Bombardier. I'm turning on the autopilot. She is all yours now. Okay, roger that. Bomber door's opening. We're on the bomb run, fellas.
Lieutenant Dillard called out. Soon, another call came over the intercom.
B-17 going down, 12 o'clock high.
Looking up, Jack started to see a B-17 from the 96th that had fallen behind start to stall as its number 3 and 4 engines were dead and oil was spilling out of its number 2 engine. The 30-ton fortress then began to fall like a falling leaf. As Jack watched the bomber disappear from his line of sight, he could feel his heart racing and his breath becoming shallow. There was a tightness in his chest that he had never felt before. A feeling of impending doom began to fall upon him. Suddenly, a flak shell exploded less than 20 feet in front of Loda Bull, and as she flew through the black cloud it left behind, an ear-piercing scream came from Reinhold, who yelled,
Lieutenant Dillard's hit! I need some help! Willie!
Jack called out over the intercom.
I'm on it, boss!
Willie said, before he quickly got out of his turret, hooked on his portable oxygen tank, and headed down to the nose. In the cockpit, Beck turned around to Jack and asked, Do you want to go down? I got things covered up here. No, it's okay. Let Willie handle it.
Navigator to pilot. It's real bad. Real bad.
Reinhold called in.
Shit. Okay. I'm on my way.
Jack said as he began unplugging his audio cord and disconnecting the oxygen. Soon, Jack was heading down to the nose. Once there, Jack became overwhelmed with the situation. With Reinhold, Willie, Dillard, and now Jack inside the nose compartment, there was now no longer room for the men to move around. Jack then called for Willie to leave the compartment, and barely squeezing between Jack and Reinhold, Willie agreed. Once Willie left and Jack had enough space to move about, that's when he headed over to Lieutenant Dillard, whose wound was now visible. He was still sitting on the bombardier's chair with his Norden bombsight between his legs. He was hunched over slightly and seemed to be using his left arm to hold on to his right arm by the wrist. As Jack positioned himself along the blood-splattered right side wall of the nose compartment, he began to examine the wound. However, it soon became apparent that Lieutenant Dillard had received several wounds. Lieutenant Dillard was hit directly in his lower shoulder by a piece of flak that, while it wasn't big enough to completely sever the arm from his shoulder, it tore directly through the bottom portion of his arm, where his armpit once was. Since blood had begun soaking up Lieutenant Dillard's clothing, blood now began pouring onto the floor of the bombardier's section of the nose. On top of that, Lieutenant Dillard had received several small puncture wounds to his face, the biggest one being a size of a quarter below his left eye. Small holes were punched into the plexiglass nose in front of him. The bomb site was also damaged, as it took a large piece of flak. First thing Jack did was to check to see if Lieutenant Dillard was still alive, as his eyes were closed and he was as stiff as he could possibly be. Taking his mask off, Jack yelled out, "Lieutenant Dillard!" As he went to feel for a pulse, Lieutenant Dillard slowly opened his right eye and looked directly at Jack and shook his head. Jack, interpreting this to mean that he was in too much pain to respond, Jack went to get the first aid kit so he could administer some morphine. As he did, that's when he saw Reinhold trying to get Jack's attention, and then pointed ahead. Looking back forward, Jack at first didn't realize what Reinhold was pointing to, but then realized what he was pointing at with the bombs falling from other planes. Quickly, Jack went over to the bomb toggle switch and hit the release button and waited for a load of bull to lift up due to the change in weight as confirmation the bombs having been released. The plane slightly lifted up and the bomb's release button indicated that the bomb successfully released and gave Jack some mental ease. Returning back to Lieutenant Dillard with his first aid kit in hand, Jack took out the syringe of morphine and gave it to him, all while the plane was turning towards the rally point. After a few minutes of trying to tend to Lieutenant Dillard, Jack realized that there was entirely too much blood pouring from his wound, and with Lieutenant Dillard's almost refusing to move his arm, with the wound itself being so close to his body, there was nowhere Jack could apply pressure to stop it from bleeding. Jack then at that point knew that there would be no way that Lieutenant Dillard was going to make it back to England.
Do you like war movies? Do they get your blood going? If so, I have the perfect podcast for you. This is not an affiliation. This isn't like we're sponsoring them, they're sponsoring us, so I got to mention them. This is just me strictly telling you about a podcast I love. The podcast is called Danger Close. It's a war film podcast where three hosts, a theater director, a movie critic, and a veteran, come together each week to talk about a different war movie. Guys, this is a fantastic podcast. If you want to get into war films on just more than just a surface level, this is perfect. The hosts are phenomenal. The research is impeccable and the quality of it is just phenomenal. I can't recommend this enough. So if you guys enjoy podcasts, you want more podcasts to make your day go by faster at work, or you wanted something to listen to while you're cleaning house or trying to fall asleep or you're driving in the car, guys, this is a perfect podcast to listen to. Danger Close, check it out for yourself. If you do, go onto the discussion page on Facebook and tell them that Aaron from Canso 34 Studios and Snafu Podcast sent you. Thank you guys so much. Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, pictures and maps of the airfield and surrounding areas, as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, and Q&A episodes. There is so much for you to gain by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast. If you would like to be a part of Snafu each week, please visit our Patreon page. The link for that's down in the show notes. Any support goes a long way in helping the podcast to continue. Your contribution is making a huge difference. Now, back to the podcast.
It had been 5 minutes and the flak had officially slowed down enough that it was no longer threatening. The formation had reached the rally point, and now heading west towards the city of Luxembourg.
Unfortunately, the escorts had not met up with the formation at the rally point, and there was no sign of them coming. Shortly after setting for a new heading, Jack made it back up to the cockpit, informed Beck about the extent of Lieutenant Dillard's wounds, and expressed the fact that he did not think that Lieutenant Dillard would make it back to England. Beck took the information well, and asked Jack if he wanted to take the controls back so he could have a look for himself and monitor the airmen. Jack objected, as there wasn't much either one of them could do. That's when Beck informed Jack that while he was tending to their wounded bombardier, Desperate Journey took a hit to their number 3 engine, and they had since fallen behind, but staying close enough that Marshy was able to still keep an eye on them. As Beck finished his update, that's when a concerned voice echoed into the intercom.
Is it a bad hit, boss?
The call was from Beans. Jack pondered whether or not he should be truthful about the indefinite fate of Lieutenant Dillard to the group. On the one hand, it wasn't something that these men hadn't heard or experienced before. Also, Lieutenant Dillard was a stranger to all these men, including Jack himself. Nobody knew him prior to starting the mission, and therefore, being informed of the situation would be nothing more than just simply sharing information. On the other hand, the sound of Beans' voice harkened back to an echo of innocence. The men might be distracted by the thought of a fellow airman slowly bleeding to death during the long flight home.
Boss?
Beans asked again. Jack fixed his oxygen mask over his face nervously and said,
Lieutenant Dillard sustained a bad hit. He is alive. How bad? Is he gonna make it back?
Asked Marshy rather directly. Being taken aback, Jack looked over at Beck, who looked uneasy. Jack then took another deep breath and said,
I'm not a doctor, but it is bad. I gave him some morphine, but I don't think there's much we can do. All we can do is hope that he makes it back. We can always bail him out,
commented Reinhold.
What?
Asked Willie.
Are you suggesting we strap a parachute on him and throw him out?
Asked Beck.
Sure, why not? Other crews have done it.
Reinhold added.
Yeah, but do you personally know anyone that actually has done it? I've heard stories, but I've never actually heard directly from someone who actually experienced it.
Mills questioned.
A crew from the 381st did it to a gunner of theirs. I heard the story myself. I'm just saying it's something else we could do. Better than taking the chance and letting him live than just dying in here.
Explained Reinhold.
Lieutenant, you really think that the Krauts are going to take care of him? Especially a guy whose job it is to send bombs to blow up their houses?
Asked Willie.
It's a possibility. I say he has a better chance of living that way than him staying here, that's all I'm saying.
Answered Reinhold.
Listen, with his wounds, would he even be able to use a parachute? I saw where he got hit. It does not look good.
Expressed Willie.
That's a good question, Willie. Lieutenant, Holt. Can you answer that?
Jack shot back, giving a glance to Beck.
Bogey spotted, 12 o'clock low.
Called Muth.
Do you see them?
Asked Beck.
No, it was just announced over the group channel. Damn it. Alright, men, get yourselves ready. Call out those spotters and make your shots count. Sir, what about coverage toward 12 o'clock?
Reinhold asked.
Manage the cheek guns. Beck, hop on the chin turret.
Jack commanded.
Aye, sir.
Beck shouted before he disconnected himself, and without question, headed down towards the nose. Jack adjusted his oxygen mask in a nervous, fidgety manner, all while the tightness in his chest had begun to form again. His heart was racing so fast that he could feel his pulse all throughout his body. Even his vision was affected. A dark, cloudy ring began to form around his line of vision, and it pulsated with every beat of his heart. Along with his vision, Jack felt as though he were slipping into a dreamlike state, where nothing on around him was real. Sudden visions of horror-filled memories such as Andy's final moments or Tango's exploded and butchered corpse began to flood his memory. These visions were so realistic that he began to smell burnt flesh and spotted blood. Jack, fearing he was going to crash into a nearby B-17 that was getting closer in order to complete tight formation, went to call Beck back to the flight deck, but he couldn't form any words over his labored breathing. That's when he heard calls coming in over the intercom.
Bandits, 2 o'clock low, here they come,
called out Tommy.
How many?
Asked Muth.
I see 4 squadrons, it looks like 109s,
Reinhold confirmed.
We got more bandits coming in, 4 o'clock high.
Beans called out.
What? Where?
Asked Willie.
Jack's breathing picked up until the sounds of Willie's top turret guns firing off seemed to shock him out of his panic state.
Oh shit, how many was that? Were those 190s?
Willie called out.
I don't know, it was a lot though.
Commented Marshy.
Shit, where's our goddamn escort?
Yelled Tommy.
Not here. Here comes another one. 3 o'clock low. Watch it, ball turret.
Beck announced.
God damn it, that was so close.
Called out Tommy.
Did you get one, Beans?
Asked Willie.
No, that wasn't me.
Beans answered.
I don't know, I'm coming in 7 o'clock high.
Called out Marshy.
190 heading right for us, 9 o'clock.
Mills added.
You're all over us. We're swarming around the front. Watch it. Radio. Shit. T 6 o'clock low. Marshy. Call in Marshy. I'm alright. I think I got a few dings on my tail, though.
That's when Jack struggled to say back.
No damage to our controls.
As Jack began to recover from his episode, that's when the horrible calls started coming in.
Short going down, 12 o'clock level. B-17 from the 528 pit. Got a fire on his outboard starting engine. Air hot. And then I'm coming around, 2 o'clock level. I see him. Oh, you almost found him, Beans. You're slicker than snow today. That B-17 from the 528's going down. I count 6 shoots. Bandit, 6 o'clock level. I can't get him. He's all yours, Marshy. 109 coming in, 2 o'clock high. I got him.
Jack knew that the bomber flying the number 2 spot was Talbot and Kime in Grey Thunder. And while he didn't see the hit, he slouched downward to peek and saw that Grey Thunder was not leaking anything. There was no visible damage.
190 coming around, 4 o'clock low.
Called in Beans.
I see him. Come on, you prick.
Answered Tommy.
So close, I heard him. Who was that?
Asked Beans.
I had no idea.
Answered Willie.
Oh shit, here comes 190s! Come running for you down in the nose! 12 o'clock high!
Announced Willie. Jack looked up and saw an incoming fighter, and saw its guns flickering, and soon beams of green tracer rounds began to appear around the cockpit. And that's when a crack was heard, followed by a spark next to Jack. Looking over to the co-pilot seat, a gold dollar-sized hole was punched into the bottom of the plexiglass window, and a similar hole was punched into the yellow seat cushion of the co-pilot seat. Behind it was a large dent with a small section where the bullet fragments had ripped through. Looking behind him and seeing that Willie wasn't hit, that's when Jack began looking around his position and saw that there was no other damage. Before he called in to see if anyone was hit, that's when calls began forming over the intercom.
Oh shit, the targeting guns are jammed,
announced Beck.
Everything all right in the nose?
Asked Jack.
Got a few flickers, nobody hit. Turret's not working now. You want me to stay down here? I command the other gun.
Beck asked.
Escort spotted, thank God.
Called out Willie.
It's about goddamn time.
Muttered Mills.
Where?
Asked Jack.
100 o'clock high, you see him?
Willie asked.
I do. You're right, Beck, you can come back up here.
Commanded Jack.
Alright, I'm coming up. Dirty Huns are leaving. They're fucking leaving.
Marshy called out as he watched the thinned-out fighter force fleeing instead of heading back for another attack. Jack saw Beck appear in the flight deck and was now looking extensively at the damage done to his window and seat. Once Beck sat down and plugged himself in, he asked,
That was a close one. Today's my lucky day.
After some small talk over the intercom, that's when Reinhold reminded the group that Lieutenant Dillard was still wounded and bleeding out down the nose. That's when Jack began to feel more annoyed than worried about the airmen. Trying to cover up that reality, Jack commanded,
Willie, since you know a thing or two about throwing people out of forts, why don't you go down and try to prepare him for bailing out?
Amidst the ball-busting comments being hurled towards Willie, Willie exited the top turret and proceeded to head down to the nose compartment. For the next 10 minutes, the intercom fell silent. Only the drowsy white noise of the engines could be heard.
Jack in this moment found himself thinking not of Marlene, but of Maggie. Thoughts of her face, specifically her smile, sent a sigh of relief to Jack, almost as a reward waiting back for him in England, something that he would be able to experience after a hard day's work. Allowing Beck to take the controls, Jack adjusted his gloves as he looked out through his pilot side window at the German countryside slipping by below. But as he looked down, he began to realize what was going on. They would be sending a wounded airman out into that beautiful yet terrifying world, never knowing his fate. What if his wounds worsen on the fall? What if he's unable to open his chute? That's when Reinhold's voice appeared over the intercom.
All right, me and Sergeant Abram have him ready to go. All right, Meath, why don't you help Willie get him down to the hatch?
Jack commanded.
Personally, sir, getting him through that crawl space is going to be hard enough. May I suggest we send him out of the bomb bay?
Asked Reinhold. That's when the muffled sound of Willie engaging the bombardier's audio input was heard over the intercom, and followed by his voice saying,
Listen, bomb bay is going to be the best way, boss. All right, if you guys say so, I'll open the bomb bay doors now.
Jack announced as he flipped the bomb bay door switch in the cockpit, and after 5 minutes had passed, Jack started to notice the drag increasing due to the open compartment and the doors hanging open.
How much longer? We're dragging now and I can't afford to use up extra fuel.
No answer was heard.
You want me to check it out?
Beck asked.
No, can you just peek your head down to see if you can at least see them?
Beck, doing what he was asked, attempted to lean over in his cramped seat at the opening that led down to the nose compartment. It did see a set of boots moving and shuffling backwards.
I see movement. Must be difficult getting him through. I should have opened the bomb bay doors once they got to the bomb bay.
Jack muttered over his breath.
Well, you never know until you know, and now you know.
Beck commented.
I like this guy, boss.
Commented Marshy. Chuckling a bit, Jack chose not to respond or interject as the intercom had become congested. Within a minute, Muth's body arose from the small opening as he attempted to help raise Lieutenant Dillard up to the flight deck, using his good hand as a way to pull him up. As he did, Lieutenant Dillard was screaming so loud in pain that Jack was able to hear him over the sounds of engines in his headphones. Both Jack and Beck looked at one another in shock, and that's when Jack gave the controls of the Bull back to Beck and attempted to supervise the movements of Lieutenant Dillard through Willie's top turret and into the bomb bay. With Muth guiding the lieutenant through the cramped space and through the many obstacles, and Willie helping to lift or push Lieutenant Dillard from behind, the group arrived at the bomb bay and then paused. After another minute passed by, and the lieutenant still hadn't jumped, Jack grew frustrated and disconnected himself, and proceeded to go back to check on the situation himself.
What seems to be the problem?
Jack yelled out, pushing his mask to the side. The three airmen were standing in the opening of the bomb bay. Willie pulled down his mask and yelled back,
He's got cold feet. I don't blame him, though. He doesn't want to jump. Does he want to live?
Jack asked.
I don't know, let me ask him.
Willie replied back rather sarcastically and quickly looked back and said,
Yes, sir, that's why he's scared to jump.
Jack then became noticeably frustrated, so much so that Willie took notice and said back,
Would you like to talk to him or push him, sir? Actually, yes.
Jack quickly responded. Willie, with a level of eagerness that was almost comical, moved out of the way so Jack could squeeze himself to where Willie was standing. Arriving at Lieutenant Dillard, that's when Jack could see straight down the bomb bay into the cloud-covered blanket of the vast nothingness. That's when he saw that Muth was actually standing on the catwalk step, with his hands on the doorframe of the compartment. Pure fear was visible in Muth's eyes, as he knew the smallest jolt to the plane could possibly send him out into the Earth's atmosphere. Grabbing hold of Lieutenant Dillard, who now had a scarf tied around his arm and torso, pinning his arm to his side, Jack could see that the lieutenant was shaking intensely and once again had his eyes closed.
Lieutenant, if you stay, you'll die. If you jump, you'll live. It's as simple as that.
Lieutenant Dillard didn't respond.
Lieutenant, you've got to jump.
Jack shouted again. Lieutenant Dillard once again didn't respond, and that's when Jack looked at Muth and the two met eyes. Muth's face showed a look of pure desperation, and with that look, Muth nodded his head, knowing what they had to do. Jack nodded back, and then forcefully moved Lieutenant Dillard closer to the catwalk step, which Lieutenant Dillard fought against hard with everything he had. However, his efforts were in vain when Jack shouted,
I'm sorry, Lieutenant!
And shoved Lieutenant Dillard off the catwalk, which the lieutenant quickly revolted by using his left hand to quickly grab onto a part of the inner rack. However, due to his weight, his hand grip didn't hold, and the scared and in-pain bombardier fell out of the bomb bay on his left side and soon disappeared into the slipstream. Once he was gone, Jack quickly helped Muth turn himself around, and the two went back to their stations. Once Jack arrived back in the pilot seat, that's when he closed the bomb bay doors and took a deep breath before plugging himself back in. Once he was plugged back in, Jack looked over at Beck, who had a look of shock on his face. That's when Jack confirmed,
"Lieutenant is out, and he's on his way to safety. Can anyone see if his chute opened? I saw him fall out, and no, I can't see him, especially with the clouds,"
Tommy commented.
"Good news is, we're actually flying over the city of Luxembourg, which reminds me, in 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, we're at the waypoint. Navigator to pilot. Set your heading to 2, 7, 8. Again, that's 2, 7, 8. Pilot to Bombardier, heading on 2, 7, 8. Roger that. Excellent work, Reinhold. Excellent job, William Muth,"
Jack confirmed over the intercom.
"I think Muth shit himself a couple times, didn't you, Muth?"
poked Willie.
"I didn't shit myself, but I do know what my trousers taste like,"
Muth shot back, much to the humorous response of the various men on board the Bull.
"Alright, man, we've done enough chit-chatting today. We can still run into Jerry out here, so hush it up. Let's do an oxygen check while we're at it."
Jack finished, as he now was setting his sights for home and felt some relief. However, that's when Jack's mind started to remind him of what he had just done. Thoughts about Lieutenant Dillard's sudden attempt to stop himself from falling began to bother Jack. What if he didn't make it? Then his final moments on Earth was hearing his pilot and chief treat him like cattle, and then in a moment of fear, pushed him out of a plane over 25,000 feet above the Earth. Just the prospect of being in Lieutenant Dillard's pain-riddled shoes made the hair on the back of Jack's neck stand up. Jack didn't know if he himself would have been able to jump, and that's when he began to wonder what would become of him or his reputation since he pushed an airman out of a fortress in the manner that he did. The question bothered Jack not so much because it would change how other people see him, but because he remembered the boss being cold and annoyed in situations like the one he was just in. And here Jack was, feeling and looking just like him.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Season 2 of Snafu. Please leave an honest review of our podcast if you haven't already on whatever podcast app you're currently listening on. If yours doesn't have a place to rate or comment, then leave us your thoughts on our Instagram or Facebook pages. Both links are down in the show notes. Snafu is produced by Kanto 34 Studios and is written and narrated by me, Seth Walters. If you'd like to find out more about what Snafu is and what we're all about, please visit our website at www.snafupod.net, and there you will find out more information about the men of the 8th Air Force and more about the podcast itself. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next time for another episode of Season 2 of Snafu.